This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks for downloading the Ruler podcast, which is sponsored by Mosquito Bikes. Mosquito will be at the London Bike Show from the 13th to the 16th of February at the Excel Centre in London's Docklands. So drop by and see their range of custom bike brands, talk to them about bike fitting, and check out some great clothing, accessory and nutrition bargains, all at stand LB1615.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast with me, Jack Thurston. This is the podcast for issue 44 of Ruler magazine, the first issue of 2014. And here with me at the Ruler offices to talk about the issue is Assistant Editor Andy McGrath. Happy New Year to you, Andy.
Happy New Year.
And first-time contributor Tom Isett. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom, you've got a tremendous piece about a little-known bike race a long time ago. But before we get on and talk about that, this is your first piece in the magazine, but you've been around in the journalism world for a while. Tell us your background and how you came to end up writing for Ruler.
Yeah, well, I've been a freelance journalist for the best part of 30 years, mostly doing stuff about motorcycles originally. I gave that up and became a boating journalist.
Is there a boating equivalent of Ruler?
Yes, and I work for it. It's a magazine called Boat International, and it's very high-end, mostly super yachts we write about, and exquisite, beautiful,
Have you got any? Does it tend to have pictures where there aren't any boats in, but there's like a bit of waste paper sort of blowing along a dusty highway?
No, it's
it's not really the equivalent.
It's fairly close in some respects, but it's a little more literal than Ruler is.
Okay, well, from Boat International to Ruler, Andy.
Yeah.
We've got a competition winner, haven't we? We should announce this first bit of business on the podcast, because on the last podcast, which was the book special one, I think it was that one, the one before, issue 43. Anyway, there was a competition to win a copy of the Ruler Tour de France 100th edition, 100th edition of the Tour de France annual. Mm. And the lucky winner of that is Jono Luan.
That's right.
Yeah. And what's the answer to the question? The question was, who are the oldest and the youngest riders in last year's tour?
And the answer was Jens Voigt and Danny Van Poppel.
Right.
So are we letting him know and
getting in touch and hoping he doesn't live in the Pacific Islands or somewhere like that? He's going to have to charter a boat from your magazine to send.
I'm sure we could find something suitable
on its way. So well done, Jono. Sorry it's taken a little bit of time to announce your success, but no doubt it's all the sweeter. Something we're starting to do in the Ruler podcast, and we're going to continue it this time, is to ask our participants in the podcast for their favourite photo or spread of photos in the magazine and why it's their favourite. Tom?
Well, for me, my favourite spread was the Paracari stone roadside markers.
So which picture we're talking about?
It's the opening spread of that article.
Okay.
Written by Colin O'Brien, I believe. And it's just something I never expected to see in a cycling race. And there is something rather lovely about these roadside markers, I think.
These are kind of kilometre markers,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. And he's collected them from all over Italy and has put them in his nearby park. And it's just mad. I mean, it's
mad.
It's fascinating, right, and great. Really interesting. Yeah, interesting and as an image, I think, really.
Yeah, no, it's funny to see them all together. Mm. But we'll come to that story in a bit. Andy, what's your spread of the issue?
Well, I was going to be really cheeky and not go for a photograph at all.
Yeah.
I was going to go for Tom Jay's spread illustration on page 70, which opens Le Circuit de Champs de Bataille, that piece about a race around the battlefields immediately post-World War One. And the problem in the press process is how do you illustrate a race where there are of course, no photos, and it's pretty much 100 years on. But luckily we got Tom, who also worked on the Centenary Tour de France annual, to do this fantastic illustration depicting the brokenness as well as the geography and all the key facts as well. And his illustrations continue in the feature, and I think we were saying earlier, it really brings it together very well.
Hmm. So, do you think we'll be seeing more illustration in Rouleau? Because this is something that Rouleau's much lamented little brother, Privateer, the Mountain Bike Mag, sadly no longer with us, they did a lot of illustration, a lot of interesting work with illustration, didn't they? And to good effect.
Yeah, I'd like to see more in there. I think different variations too, and not even just illustrations. We had a comic in, a Ferdy Kubler comic strip about 15 issues ago, and I thought that was great. If we can keep impressing and surprising people with, you know, quality illustrations or comics, that would be great as well.
I always like magazines that are a bit like a sort of cabinet of curiosities where you're not quite sure what's going to be in there, and that came out very well in the Tour de France annual with various bits of ephemera photographed and sort of pasted in, so it has a little bit of a kind of cabinet of curiosities or scrapbook feel about things. I mean, with print, you know, in this battle with digital media, it's one of the things that I think doesn't work so well on the screen, whereas in print it's actually in front of you.
Yeah,
I like this image by Tim Kern. Maybe it's a famous image, I don't know if it's been seen before. Juan Antonio Fletcher on a training ride.
That's right.
With his sort of blurred image of him, double page spread, black and white, kind of gloomy. It's clearly in the middle of winter, and there is a car upside down in a ditch on the side of a very straight road, which I'm thinking, how did that car get to be there? Can we see the... unless Tim Cohen put it there in the sort of classic phony war photographer sort of...
It's actually Tim's own car, yeah. That's real commitment to the job, isn't it?
I was thinking of the sort of the ragged doll sort of thrown in front of the...
Pair of shoes in the pool of blood.
Yeah, yep. Exactly, that kind of shot. But no, it's this car here. We can see some tracks, tyre tracks, possibly sort of skid going down there. Whether the driver of the car just got bored driving down this long, flat, straight road and just sort of drifted off.
I've done exactly the same thing. It's two tyres on black ice and two tyres not, and suddenly you're sideways up the road.
So, okay.
I'm guessing that's possibly what happened.
Thanks for the forensics. But I sometimes do see this sort of thing. I saw one of those lorries called that move other vehicles. Not like
a loader. Low loaders?
Just like a tug, but for
right.
See, I'm getting into your world. Boat speak.
Boat speak.
A sort of tug van.
With winches on.
A sort of winch on. Got a great big hook on the back, and it looks like it's very powerful, and obviously it is.
Big tow truck.
Big tow truck. It's a tow truck. One of these on its side in a hedge.
Oops.
Outside Lechlade. With all the floods. I don't know. I think as a cyclist, there's something quite nice about seeing an upside-down car in a ditch. But, you know, it's also a nice photograph with all the lines, good composition.
And a lot of traffic on that road as well. Mm. It doesn't look like a fun place to be training.
No, and it's interesting because Juan Antonio is not really adopting the primary position.
He's not.
He's right on the line that demarcates the verge from the asphalt. So he needs to do some cycle training.
I think the CTC need to get in touch.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, if they get used to riding on closed roads, you see,
yep.
They don't know what to do when there's a car about.
I bet he doesn't stop at red lights all the time either, or indicate,
not
or
during
signal with his
not
hands.
During races. I think.
Scandalous.
Although they do have to stop at level crossings, don't they?
Oh yeah,
that is one of the things that happens in bike races that can't be sort of catered for.
Mm. I really enjoy that on the occasions that it does happen, and the ones I can only remember are Paris-Roubaix. Actually,
yeah,
they must have happened in loads of other races, and then they always try to restart. There's been a breakaway. With the same advantage, but inevitably never.
Do they try? Do they try and restart? I thought it's just. I think, you know,
tough.
Yeah.
But then in the past, you've had examples of people climbing through trains with their bicycles,
yes,
and out the other side,
yeah,
and all this kind of stuff.
Well, there's an extraordinary bit of CCTV footage that was doing the rounds a couple of months ago about a woman cycling along towards a crossing, and it's flashing and sort of. I think it has come down, actually, and she somehow managed to skirt around it. The train comes along, and she puts on the brakes so fast that her back wheel, she does an endo, and manages to sort of
inches.
Not get completely smashed to smithereens, and then sort of cycles off.
Wow.
Yeah, be careful out there with level crossings. Right, let's turn to the contents of the magazine. Tom, you're writing about a stage race that takes place in the immediate aftermath of the First World War.
Yep, 1919.
Extraordinary. I mean, people, I think, who are familiar with cycle racing will know that there was the 1919 Paris-Roubaix, and that
yep.
was the race that caused Eugène Christophe to say, "This is the Hell of the North."
I have heard people say that actually that description, the Hell of the North, was applied to the area rather than a specific race.
Right.
And that actually the Circuit de Champ de Bataille, as it's known, maybe that was the origin of that.
Interesting. Did you manage to pin that down in your research?
I'm still trying.
Yeah. So what were they thinking?
Well, it was the classic thing where a newspaper needed to increase its circulation, so they thought they would organise a race after the First World War around the battlefields. There was a huge tourist industry immediately after the war for people to come and visit the battlefields.
Really? Is that not regarded as bad taste?
Well, the problem was that most people killed never came home. So relatives, in order to have some kind of closure, they very often went to the battlefields.
So it was a kind of, I mean, you could call it tourism, but it was very much a... Well, not like tourism, but
memorial
2 weeks
tourism.
In Tenerife. It's,
it was memorial
it's going
tourism.
To see where your family had disappeared into the mud.
Yeah, and Michelin produced a set of guidebooks in 1919 for people who were motoring around these battlefields. It's quite extraordinary to our modern way of thinking, but that's how it was in those days. So the French newspaper Le Petit Journal decided they were going to have a race around the battlefields, and they did, in horrific conditions and on terrible roads.
There was a political edge to organising a race as well, wasn't there? As there often was in those days, on the early days of these big bike races, to sort of demarcate territory.
Absolutely. At the end of the war, the French got Alsace-Lorraine back from the Germans, who had annexed it 70 years earlier. And this this race ran all the way along the new boundary, as if to say, you know, this is now ours.
It's like beating the bounds.
Exactly that. That was part of it. I mean, all this was happening before the Treaty of Versailles had even been signed. So, you know, this was literally minutes after the end of the war.
And there's an influenza epidemic raging.
Yes.
I'm almost amazed that there were roads at all.
Well, there weren't really. You know, most of the roads were dirt tracks before the war and were now filled with shell holes and, you know, the leftovers of warfare. So, the conditions were horrendous.
And it was a multi-day, a five-day race. Was
five-day
it?
Race.
And very, very long stages.
Yeah.
Was that typical of the time, or were these particularly long, or were they particularly bad given the conditions? Because in the 1920s, races were getting longer and longer, weren't they? It was that era of sort of 350-kilometre, 400-kilometre stages.
Yeah, I mean, Bordeaux-Paris, for instance, you know, that was 500-odd kilometres. So these weren't particularly long by the standards of the time. But if you could imagine, you know, cycling across a ploughed field for 300 kilometres, that's almost what they had to do. And they also had problems with knowing where they were going because there were no road signs, there was no road book. And there are instances of people having to get off their bikes and search through the rubble to find out where they actually were and where they had to go next.
But yet it attracted the top riders of the time. I mean, sadly, many of the best riders of the pre-war era didn't make it through the war, or I suppose retired during the war. So it was a diminished peloton.
Yeah, a lot of the French riders perished in the First World War. There were, I mean, I think we've found the names of something like 70 of them who died. But this race attracted some quite serious riders. Oscar Egg was, you know, one of the greatest champions of Switzerland. There were some great French and Belgian riders racing, mainly because it had a huge purse, this race. They, you know, it was an 8,000 franc prize for the winner, which was a huge amount of money in those days.
And so did it have the desired effect for the circulation of Le Petit Journal?
That I don't know. They didn't do it again because it turned out to be such hard work. So Le Petit Journal continued publishing for decades afterwards, but they didn't organise another race like this. The next one they did was a flying race.
Right. And do you think the reason why we don't know much about this race, thanks to your researches, we now do know much more about it. Do you think that's because it was not organised by Lotto and Desgranges and the myth makers? Why did it fall through the cracks in the floorboards of cycling history?
I think it was such a brutal experience for everyone concerned that nobody was...
Wouldn't that add to the appeal to people trying to memorialise sort of such an event? Are there no photographs?
Well, I suppose that's part of it. I think there were other things that were relevant. For instance, the Tour of Flanders. It kind of trod on the toes of the Tour of Flanders in some respects. And that had far more prestige and history behind it. And I think that, you know, there wasn't room for both of those races. I think it had to be one or the other. And the Tour of Flanders won.
And there were some fantastic stories in here of of overcoming adversity through the terrible conditions. For example, I'm just looking at an illustration of a rider who donned a woman's fur coat to make it to the finish. But I was wondering, as there were no photographs and very little testimony, how did you research all these things and get all these fantastic details?
Well, fortunately, it was very well reported by Le Petit Journal itself.
Right.
And all of those copies are available in the French National Archive.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of time with my friend Savan translating
French
newspapers into English to glean the details. So, yeah, that was a lot of rummaging through the Bibliothèque Nationale.
I see, and that's online. It's not
that's
in
online.
Paris or anything, is it?
No, okay, that, fortunately, that's online. I didn't actually have to go to Paris to do that. Oh, so
that's handy.
Yeah.
Had you heard about this race, Andy?
Not really, which is why it's a delight to have in the magazine too. I mean, if I'd heard of it, it was only in the kind of vaguest sense.
Well, I stumbled across it when I was reading an e-book called 100 Tours, 100 Tales by Suze Clemetson. And she mentioned, just in a paragraph, that this race had happened. I thought, that sounds really interesting. So started to do some research, and that's kind of where it started.
Yeah, and I haven't read that e-book. Is it good?
I love it, yeah. It's excellent.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It's on my list. I think she's quite interesting because she's Francophone and therefore is able to draw on a lot of materials that the
rest
Anglophone
of the struggle
researchers and journalists don't. And you often find, I think, in the English-speaking world, or the English writing world, about cycling, particularly about continental cycling, the same sort of stories seem to go round and round and round, and it's almost as if everyone's just referring to someone else's account, which is backed up by someone else's, and then you end up in a sort of circle, and you're never quite sure what's actually the truth about the matter.
No, these things become carved in stone where they may not necessarily...
Yeah. Andy, you are a young member of the Ruler team, I think it's fair to say, very youthful chap.
But thank you.
In researching this story, you must have felt like an old geezer.
That's right.
Your story in the magazine.
Well, the opening story is it's about the junior peace race, and part one, anyway, is being embedded with the ODP, which is the Olympic Development Programme. So it's a best 16 to 17-year-old British cyclist. And I think, luckily, I'm still just about young enough to kind of remember the teenage drive and what it was like. Because it isn't just about their ambitions and their dreams and their goals to ultimately all succeed in professional cycling, which, frankly, brutally, one or two may have successful careers, but the rest won't. But it's also just about being a teenager and, say, the awkwardness of that sometimes. It was funny... say on the start lines, the pro peloton normally rushes out of their gleaming team buses with a minute to spare to avoid us annoying hacks, or just because they have it dialed in, that routine. But 15-20 minutes before the start, the whole of the junior peace race peloton will be there.
Getting anxious, cold.
Getting cold. And barring a few, they all keep in their own circles, either silent or chatting to one another, but you can sense the anxiety, and every day is so important to them. It's a really nice reminder, because sometimes with the World Tour pros, it is very businesslike, and it does become a routine, of course, because they're doing sometimes 100 race days every year. But with these, and I went to Junior Paris-Roubaix too, they really value putting on that national jersey every single time, and they're really fighting for everything. It was a strange experience, because a junior peace race is in northern Bohemia in the Czech Republic, about an hour's train ride from Prague, which is how I got there, actually. The Prague metro is fantastic, but anyway, it's a strange place because it's in Litomyrzice, I hope that's the right pronunciation. It's a beautiful Bohemian, typically Bohemian town, but the HQ is a race HQ. It's in Terezin, which is a few kilometres down the road. And that was the scene of a Holocaust atrocity, basically. It was turned into a ghetto, and I think a quarter of the people in there perished. So the disparity between those two things, and the fact that Terezin doesn't seem to have recovered at all, it's chilling going round the ghetto museum, which is what I did with Matt Winston, the ODP coach, and Martin, the mechanic there. It's like going to the Imperial War Museum. It isn't something we should ever forget. And it's always shocking, yeah. And the riders don't see that, but they don't have to, because they still get the impression that it's an eerie, empty place. Like, the grass hasn't been cut for most of it. It's just quite strange, yeah.
So tell us about the Olympic Development Programme. Is that the conveyor belt that's been pushing out all these great British riders over the last, 10 or 15 years? Is this a sort of Peter Keane initiative? Is this the thing that we have to thank for all the medals that have been raining down on British cyclists over the last few years?
I'm not certain if it came along with the Academy. I think the Academy with Rod Ellingworth and Peter Keane, that was first. But this has certainly been along the last 5 years, I think. Well, that's why I was curious, because recent world medalists like Lucy Garner, Eleanor Barker have come through here. And Matt, the coach, was saying that when they first joined, they were very quiet, they're quite shy, but he also enjoyed seeing them not just change as cyclists into world beaters, but changing as people who are now, you know, eloquent, bubbly, everything you'd expect from an adult. Yeah.
And is there a typical route into this programme for the riders that you could discern amongst those that you spent time with?
Into the ODP?
Yeah.
I think the big fight for selection on the ODP, because some riders in the team are already part of the programme and some can be drafted in from outside, is in the British Junior Racing Series. So they'll be, all the Brits will be going at it hammer and tongs. And then, that's quite funny too, because as soon as they're picked for an international race, the mantra is to always ride as a team, no matter what happens. So you go from potentially flicking your rival in the ditch in a British race to having him help you in Czech Republic. That's cycling too, isn't it? As well, I suppose.
You spent some time with Tao Gegenhardt, who is much talked about, not least because he's a Londoner from Hackney. What do you reckon?
First,
going to be a star?
Yeah.
Or it already is a star?
The pronunciation, I'm not sure how to say his name. I think it's Tao Gegenhardt.
Oh, right, okay.
But certainly when I was at Junior Paris-Roubaix and his name was on the PA because he was on the podium, the French commentator was absolutely butchering it. Okay. I heard Tao Jommingham, and I'm sure he'll get a lot of name problems in the next few years.
Well, we've put a call in to Phil Liggett to get the correct pronunciation. Will you do that, Tom?
Yeah.
Because I've obviously fouled it up.
Well, I'm just going to interrupt the podcast to tell you that the correct pronunciation we have discovered is Tao Gegenhardt. That's Tao Gegenhardt. So I guess Andy had it half right and I had it half right. Apologies, Tao. Back to the podcast.
But yes, he is of that group, I suppose. He is already the outstanding talent. I mean, and he's got it already. He's got that star quality. It's kind of hard to pinpoint, but there was a time when he was just standing on the podium and he had his arms around one of the girls, and he's got a David Miller type way of moving, a confidence that isn't becoming of a 16-year-old. I mean, I wish I'd been that confident when I was 16, 17. And he's very intelligent, and not just in a bike race, but outside of it. I mean, I think he got some very good A-levels, and he's naturally friendly. Like, on the flight back, the EasyJet flight back from Prague, I remember that he came back and sat and chatted with me, which pro cyclists wouldn't do, and it, because they don't have to. But he's telling me about the essay he was writing for English A-level, things like that. So he's got his head screwed on well, and I think he could go far, yeah.
And the racing. I mean, there's a quote in your piece about the red mist.
The red mist.
This is sort of basically racing at full gas all the time and blowing yourself up, being a particular problem, I suppose, for young, enthusiastic riders, that the tactical nous hasn't quite yet taken over. They're still quite headstrong. Does that affect the racing? Was it entertaining racing? Were you able to get a sense of what was going on in the races, even? Because I suppose they're not televised.
No.
They? So
it's,
I mean,
a very
you
small
see
affair.
What's going on.
No, we were the only journalists there, actually. But I was mainly in Team Cars, either with I think I was in with Holland, GB, and Denmark. It was a strange junior race, because I remember being in the car with Matt Winston, the coach, and he was saying, this isn't how it should be. There weren't that many attacks going, whereas normally you can't stop them, apparently. But Denmark, being the strong force on the junior scene, were controlling everything in a in a US postal style, just without any of the bad connotations that has.
Or a Team Sky.
A Team
style.
Sky. So,
without any of the bad connotations. Oh, no, sorry. edit that bit out.
There was a big mountain on stage three, climbed twice, and that had a huge effect. That exploded the bunch, and that was impressive to see. That could have been an adult race, kind of the way they were dealing with it tactically and the effect it had on the riders. Yeah, that could easily have been riders 10 years older in the World Tour, because it ended up being a group of 6-7 who were left, and that was real racing. Yeah,
a very interesting piece. I had no idea about that aspect of the sport at all. So from my point of view, it's very interesting to read.
You know, it is something that I think Rouleau as a magazine has done more than any other publication that I can think of, is to look at the pyramid that leads to, you know, the top of the sport, to see how it is that riders are made.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting part of that story, Andy.
They're different. Well, that's the interesting thing. They're doing things differently, like, they're making the teenagers build their bikes before the race.
Mm.
And even having Matt Winston as coach, who is a 26-year-old, that is completely unorthodox. I mean, normally DSs are these old, broad, 55-year-old somethings with cigarettes hanging out of their mouths and bellowing on the loudspeaker. Okay, that's a stereotype, but you know what I mean. I mean, they're ex-racers who have been there, done it, and got the T-shirt. Yep. So he brings something completely new, and I'll be very interested to see where he goes in the future too, because it's his future that should be considered too. I think he said that he wouldn't mind eventually possibly going to the Olympics as a coach at some point. And with his current progression, I think that's very possible, yeah.
Well, you heard it here first, and you can read about it in the magazine. Let's talk about kilometre rocks, kilometre stones, milestones.
Bollards, they are.
Bollards. Well, that's the thing, you see. We talk in kilometres, don't we, in RULA?
Yeah, we do, yeah.
But the English word for these things is milestones. Mm-hmm. So these milestones have been collected from around Italy, maybe even around the continent of Europe, and assembled into a kind of memorial garden in the foothills of the Dolomites in the Trentino province of northern Italy by a chap called Dario Pegoretti, who's no relation of the famous frame builder of the same name. And each milestone, it looks as though there's about several dozen, has been dedicated to a particular rider. And he's also he's sort of tried to make a certain connection, hasn't he, the collector, with the rider, so that the one that he's dedicated to Laurent Fignon goes slightly yellow in the it's a certain kind of limestone that goes slightly yellow in the rain.
Yeah.
I like collections, Tom.
Yep.
When you collect a lot of the same thing in the same place, as long as it's not identical, you appreciate the milestoneness of the milestone in a way that you wouldn't when you just look at one.
That's true.
Over last summer, I went to a sort of steam rally in the Forest of Dean, which had all kinds of steam engines, some that moved and some that were just sort of static, that would be driving some kind of apparatus in the pre-electric age. And there was a guy there with a stand showing off his collection of porcelain and glass sort of insulators that would sit on the top of electricity pylons or telephone pylons, to sort of that the wires would go around those to sort of insulate the whole thing. You know, the kind of things that they're usually sort of white.
Yep.
But he's got this collection from across Europe and across the world, and there's apparently a whole scene of people who swap these things, climb up and electrocute themselves, fishing them down. But once you see about 40 or 50 or 60, as he had on his shelves, all slightly different colours, different shapes, different sizes, you start thinking about something that you would never have given a second glance.
Yes.
I got the same reaction to looking at this piece. I'd seen milestones, and they're always quite nice to look at a milestone, but I never really paid much attention to its shape or its design or its colour. But now I think I will.
They are quite extraordinary, and the differences I've found quite fascinating. Yeah, but what sort of madman does that? I mean, that's the.
Is he thieving them? Are they stolen property? Or
no, people have donated them.
Well, have they thieved them?
Donated, yeah.
Possibly.
Okay.
I wouldn't like to say.
There might be some missing milestones around the place.
It just seems like an utterly bonkers thing to do. But that's why it makes good reading, I think.
I think that cycling is a sport that feeds obsession and obsessions. So in that respect,
you think we're all obsessive in one way or another?
Well, if we're serious cycling fans, some can be, yeah. Mm. So I think that takes the edge of the bonkersness just a little bit. It's still bizarre, though.
So which do you think comes first, the obsession or the cycling? Does cycling drive people to obsession, or does cycling give already obsessive people a good, healthy outlet for their obsessive behaviours?
Good question. I would say cycling certainly gave me the outlet to be obsessive. So perhaps there's that element within you. You just need to find the right pastime or sport.
Find the medium.
Yeah.
I'm reminded also of the piece in the magazine a few years ago about speed play pedals and the guy who runs
every single one.
But he's got a big collection of of pedals of the last 80 years. So yeah. This is the guy who basically reinvented the pedal, if you like, by attaching most of the pedal to the shoe.
Yeah.
But he's got all the sort of classic, you know, leotard type rat trap pedals on a display case, and there was a nice double page spread, as I recall, looking of all these different pedals. And again, once they're all aligned together, you start to pay them more attention than you would if there was just one there.
Yep.
Do you have a collection? Do you collect anything, Tom?
I get bored of my collection.
What have you collected?
I start and then get bored. I have a small collection of arrowheads.
Oh, right. Like ancient ones.
Ancient ones,
that
modern
you found
ones.
In the woods and things.
A variety of them. Archery is something that I'm quite interested
in. Oh, that must be interesting.
Well, that's, again, another sad, obsessive hobby.
How many have you got?
I have two bows. I have a traditional longbow.
But how many arrowheads?
Oh, arrowheads I have, I don't know, 80, something right. like that. All different sorts, different ages.
And do you display them in a nice case?
I started to, and then I thought, no, this is no way to carry on. I'm a grown man. Stop it. So
they're in a drawer somewhere. Andy, have you got any collections?
The only thing that I collect, Jack, are the most inane, pointless, and geeky cycling facts in my own head to bore my friends with. No, I
you added any new acquisitions
of course,
to the collection lately?
It's always ongoing.
Care to share?
Bizarre winners of South American races. It's funny what you find sticks in your head, though, sometimes, just from reading cycling websites. And like, I have a memory for who won a Giro in that year, but all the stuff I did for my degree, like Hamlet and essays I wrote, I can't remember any quote. Is terrible. I'm kind of forgetting the important things, aren't I? Yeah.
I have a collection that I kind of start each year, actually around about this time of the year, and then it never really makes it till the end of the year. So the collection always just begins each year, and then is somehow lost to the four winds. Mm. And it's a collection of those wrappers of blood oranges, in particular. From Sicily, you know, very nicely designed sort of tissue paper. Yeah. You know, when you get you see the blood oranges or other kinds of premium citrus fruit, probably I might diversify into other
Amaretti next. Sure.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think they're all. I don't think you get so much variety or interesting design. Do you?
Maybe not. I don't know.
I think oranges are healthier than biscuits, aren't they? I collect those. I would like to. make it through a few years and see what I can come up with.
Well, why not?
Maybe this should be a call to, because they're very lightweight. So if you're listening to the Ruler podcast in Sicily, for instance, where a lot of these citrus fruits are grown, and you want to send a few samples from your rubbish bin, send them to me at Ruler in Holborn. You'll find the address on the website, ruler.cc.
But also, if you're the editor of a fruit-based magazine, in a few years, track down Jack Thurston and do a feature on his many orange wrappers.
Have you written for any fruit-based magazines, Tom?
No, I haven't.
Is there a Ruler equivalent of fruit-based
there must
magazines?
Be. There must be, surely.
Surely, yeah.
Oh, dear. Let's talk about photography and... the feature, which is entitled A Brief History of Cycling Photography, Speed. Now, this suggests to me that this is part of a series. Is that right, Andy?
That's right. This is the first in an 8-long series from Duncan Forbes, who is the director of the Photo Museum in Winterthur in Switzerland. He had this idea of this column explaining more about photography and cycling, kind of connecting a lot of the basic feelings and emotions and things we see in the sport to photography. And he's picked speed as the first one, which is one of the hardest things for a camera to capture. I mean, how can you possibly get in one frame something that is always moving? I mean, how can you capture speed? Do you even think, Jack and Tom, that speed can be truly captured by a camera?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't. There's a word for the experience of speed or experience of motion, and it's kinesthetic, and cycling has got a kinesthetic quality, as does running or, you know, diving off a high board into a swimming pool. There is some trouble to be had in rendering that. I think there's trouble to be had in rendering that in words. It can be done. I think people have done it. I think photography is actually one of the harder mediums to render that kinesthetic quality of cycling in. And I think Duncan Forbes does discuss the challenges, particularly because I think the early photographers were fascinated by the possibility of photography as a way of stopping motion.
Yep.
And the early photographers, you know, were desperate to catch things that the human eye couldn't see. So famously, it was the bet about whether a horse, I can't remember whether it's all four legs leave the ground or all four legs are on the ground when a horse is galloping. And that was that Edward Maybridge.
Yeah, it was. He did a series of photographs to show that the traditional Stubbs oil paintings where they're all 4 feet off the ground.
Never happens.
Never happens. Okay. Whatever.
So they've always got a foot. Remember. They've always got a foot on the ground.
I may have got that wrong, but that was the idea of Maybridge.
Right. Yes. And so it does seem as though a lot of cycling photography has that quality to it. I mean, not least because of the people who are commissioning and paying for cycling photography, which is magazines that have wanted to show and newspapers that have wanted to show the identity of the riders rather than just this kind of blur that you might use to portray speed.
I've often found that the mountain bike magazines do it so much better. If you look at the photography in some of the mountain bike magazines, they get that impression of speed and movement far more than I think the road cycling ones do.
Is that because the cyclists that they're photographing are kind of 6 foot in the air?
Possibly something to do with it. And they have possibly more control over how
they know where it's going to happen.
Yeah. You know, obviously covering a stage race is very, very difficult.
Yeah. It's interesting thinking about this. Some of the early Cubo futurist painters got a bit of a thing about trying to portray the act of cycling. And I think they did quite a good job of it. The more you abstract from sort of the highly representational, you know, photographic image, the more, in a way, you can convey that feeling that's very intangible.
There's that very famous painting, I think it was by Picasso, of a nude going down a staircase, which is one of those cubist ones, which has an amazing feeling of motion. And yet, when you look and analyse it, it's just squares and shapes.
Yeah. Let's talk about how cycling is presented in TV, because I think actually it's quite linked to the limits of that Duncan describes in the piece on still images, because I don't think you really get a very good sense from the still images of the speed of the cyclists, certainly in the images that he's presented here, and I don't think you get a particularly good sense from the television footage of cycling as it's shown today.
No.
What should be done about that? Do you agree with me on that?
Well, I've spent a lot of my life writing about motorcycles and going to MotoGP races, and I've seen a huge change in the way that it's covered on television. And, you know, they now have onboard cameras. They have these gyroscopic onboard cameras, which give you a fantastic view of what the rider is doing. And you never really see that in cycling. You know that they're descending fast, but it's filmed from a helicopter, you know, many hundred metres up. And so you don't get that kind of fluid descent and feeling of speed that you do in a MotoGP race, for instance. And I would love to see some kind of onboard footage from cycling, if it's possible, but I don't know the technical, you know.
Andy, what do you reckon? Do you think what could be improved with the technology that we've got at the minute?
Well, I think firstly it would be nice to just get the sound of the bunch passing sometimes, like in MotoGP or Formula One or anything with a motor you hear. It would be nice to capture that. My knowledge of cycling TV history, broadcasting history, isn't great, but I don't think it's really changed much in the last 20 years. You still just have a number at the top telling you how many K to go, and the breakaway. There can be so much more done with, say, with F1, you could have potentially, possibly race radio on the TV. You could have certain riders' heart rates on the TV, which I think they tried.
They
even
did
10 years
that.
Ago.
Did they? What happened to that? Was that not perceived as something that was useful or informative or interesting, or was it trade secrets?
It was 40 as well. It was 40 at times. Sometimes you had a rider and his heart rate would be showing zero beats per minute, and other times it would be 300 if it was going past some pylons or something. So they'd maybe put it on hold until it was accurate. But that would be interesting to see. There can be a lot more done, and mountain biking and BMX and things like that are starting to have kind of GoPro runs, which does offer a lot more. I mean, it would be great to see a technical descent kind of nailed by an able descender with a camera on his forks.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's also about the lightness of the filming technology to enable that without unbalancing the bicycle. I mean,
there's a lot of time in a bike race that is quite boring on the TV. Up till, you know, the last 1 minute in some stages of stage races, at least. If you had cameras on helmets or on the bikes, you know, you'd be able to portray a little bit more what's going on in the race. You'd be able to show riders working their way back up. You'd be able to show the proximity that riders have with one another in the peloton, which would be quite educational to people watching, that they would understand a little bit more about the nuances of the sport by just seeing it.
Do you think the riders may object to that, though? Because, you know, you would also see who's soft-pedalling and chatting to his mates and not actually doing an awful lot of work.
Or who's fighting. Any infringements in the bunch could more easily be picked up upon by the commissaires.
Yep.
But I think it would be... It's more and more that I hear from interviewees, oh, I bet it looked easy on TV, but actually it wasn't. Like, if you can see that cut and thrust, maybe the fight for positions in the final 5K, or diving down a mountainside, like on the kind of on the edge of traction with your wheels, that would give a new element to it.
Yeah,
I mean, it'd be great to have sort of onboard cameras for lead-out trains and that kind of thing in you know, sprint finishes. It'd be extraordinary to see, you know, how that space is found by riders in the last, you know, 500 meters. I also thought that we're not too far away from having drones with cameras on board, in addition to the two helicopters that are obviously quite expensive to run and noisy and all the rest of it. You could have a lot of drones, and they probably could come in a lot closer than a helicopter can come to take footage.
It's going to require some skillful flying from somebody, but
well, you know, ex-riders could be, you know, you could have Sean Yates
piloting
the drones.
Yep.
This makes me think of Star Wars, to be
Mark
honest.
Cavendish,
I don't know why.
Watch out, hadn't he?
Yeah.
Or Drone Wars.
Drone Wars, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's just unmanned helicopters. Well, if you've got a good idea for how cycling television coverage can be improved, drop us a line.
And we'll tell the UCI, and they'll say no.
Well, they might say yes in a few years' time.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, I think that just about wraps it up. I mean, there's a lot more in the magazine. We've got the second half of Andrew Curry's feature on the Arctic race, featuring photographs by Tim Kern, very scenic part of Norway by the looks of things, with some very enthusiastic locals. We've got columns by Matt Seaton and Robert Miller, and we've got, what else have we got in here? Oh yeah, here we are, the Danes. Danes. What are the Danes writing about, Andy?
Well, Morten Ogbo and Jakob Christian Sørensen have done a piece.
Sorry, Guy just always refers to them as the Guy in refer to them as the Danes.
They are our Danes. It's a loving term.
It is.
Term of affection.
We love Danes.
They've done a piece on Rosella Bonfanti, who is RCS's source of sure information. So she's a conduit between the race organisation and the teams. So she passes it all on. It's very interesting.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating insight into how these things are run, because, again, as a relative amateur. I have no idea how these things are put together. And to see, you know, that there's one lady with four radios and a phone kind of pulling it all together, I found fascinating.
That's the other thing. I mean, she's a lady, and cycling is a traditionally chauvinist sport. But I didn't even...
She can multitask. That's it, you see. That's what it's all
well,
about.
Well, but yeah, I didn't even pick up she was a she until I just reread it about an hour ago. I was like, oh, yeah. Of course. So.
Well, the photo spread of her with the umbrella didn't give it away.
It's a giveaway, but
there's something about her that reminds me of that police officer character played by Frances McDormand in Fargo.
Ah, you see, I had her down as Blanche from Coronation Street.
Okay. Well, you can make your own mind up when you take a look at issue 44 of Ruler magazine. Thanks to Andy McGrath and Tom Isitt. Cheerio. Bye.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc, or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.